This week on the Electronic Intifada podcast, the U.S. Supreme Court decides not to hear the case of five men convicted to decades in prison for their work with the Holy Land Foundation, delivering charity to the occupied Gaza Strip. We'll have an exclusive interview with attorney Linda Moreno about the court's decision.
In this case, which we concluded was a co-production with the government of Israel against these Palestinian men, it lacked all legal precedent and common sense.
Also, the United Nations finds a, quote, crisis of dignity as Israeli settlers destroy or damage more than 1,000 Palestinian olive trees in the West Bank in October alone. Sounds from Not a Dreamland, a multimedia project featuring artists and alternative subcultures in Gaza, and news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement as the chair of the African National Congress backs the boycott and declares that Israel has implemented a system, quote, far worse than apartheid South Africa. I'm Nora Barrows-Friedman, associate editor for the Electronic Intifada in Berkeley. We continue our reporting on the Holy Land Foundation and the fate of its jailed leaders. After 11 years of trials and appeals, the leaders of the Holy Land Foundation, who were convicted and jailed for giving charity to Palestinians, attempted their last legal recourse in the Supreme Court in the hopes that the court would decide to hear the case. But last Monday, October 29th, the court announced that it would not hear the case. The Holy Land Foundation was once the largest Islamic charity organization in the U.S. The HLF provided disaster relief aid across the country in addition to providing essential humanitarian aid to Palestinians under Israel's military occupation. In 2001, under the Emboldened Patriot Act, the Bush administration shut down the Holy Land Foundation and charged its founders with working through charity or zakat committees, quote, on behalf of Hamas, even though the committees the charity donated to were the same that USAID, the U.S. Agency for International Development, had also donated to. During the trial, the government's key evidence relied on testimony from an anonymous Israeli intelligence officer, the first time in U.S. history when an expert witness testified under a pseudonym, making it both impossible for the defense attorneys to properly vet and cross-examine the prosecution's star witness, and for the accused to confront their accuser, which violates the Sixth Amendment of the Constitution. In its announcement that it would not hear the Holy Land Five case, the U.S. Supreme Court ignored the defense's petition, which laid out how the U.S. government's prosecutors violated the Sixth Amendment. In a press release from the Muslim Legal Fund of America issued on Monday, representatives of the organization stated that they were, quote, deeply troubled at the Supreme Court's dismissal of the importance of the case. Joining us to talk about the significance of the Supreme Court's decision not to hear the Holy Land Five case and the political and legal ramifications of that decision is attorney Linda Moreno. Moreno was co-counsel for Ghassan Elashi, who is the chairman of the board, and was sentenced to 65 years in prison. Linda, thank you so much for being with us today on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Good to be with you.
So if you could talk about really your reaction as an attorney and as a member of the defense's legal team to the Supreme Court's decision this week.
Well, it was, I believe, for the lawyers, it was heartbreaking. We have been fighting for many years for the defense of these men in the Holy Land case. We went through two trials, appeals in the lower court, all the way up to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court decided against hearing our cert petition. It was heartbreaking, and it's just another chapter in this case, a shameful chapter in this case, I would add, of the injustice of the Holy Land Foundation charity and the rule of law that has been violated in this case. We analogize the Holy Land Foundation verdicts and the decision of the Supreme Court not to hear this very worthy appeal to the Korematsu and the Dred Scott decisions in the Supreme Court. Both decisions were lauded at the time and applauded as being constitutional. We now know decades later, centuries later, for the Dred Scott decision, that this was a shameful, shameful chapter in our legal jurisprudence. And we think the Holy Land Foundation will be seen in the same light and the same perspective in the future.
Linda, what legal, social, and political precedent does this set in the current climate in the U.S. when it comes to the expanding attacks, the surveillance, and the racism against Arabs and Muslims and people who stand up for Palestinian rights?
Well, I can certainly speak to the first. I can certainly speak to the legal aspect, and at the heart of our appeal, and at the heart of the convictions that we suffered in the second trial. Remember, there were two trials, and in the first trial, no one was convicted of any count. In the second trial, the government had an anonymous expert testify along with other anonymous witnesses. And what I mean by that is that witness's anonymity even extended to the judge. Nobody, not the defense and not the judge, knew the identity of this witness who was allowed to testify. And really what that means is that there could be no effective cross-examination. If I don't know your name and I don't know who you are, I can't research you. I can't find out if what you're saying is true or not. It renders the right of cross-examination and confrontation meaningless. And this was the heart of our appeal to the court. It is unprecedented in American jurisprudence that an expert has been allowed to testify anonymously. I will also want to say that really in the Holy Land Foundation case, in my view anyway, I believe that Islam was criminalized, that the religion was criminalized at its heart. This case was about charity. It was about zakat. And the government conceded in this case that every penny that the Holy Land Foundation raised went to the needy. Not a nickel went to buy a bullet, a gun, or a weapon of any sort. But the United States government decided it just didn't like the way it went to the needy, meaning that the donations were funneled through on-the-ground zakat committees to the needy. And these were zakat committees that were used by our government, like USAID, the United Nations, and other NGOs had used these very same zakat committees. But in this case, which we concluded was a co-production with the government of Israel against these Palestinian men, it lacked all legal precedent and common sense. And it held, I believe, the religion up to ridicule and perverted its meaning. And so I don't know, I can't speak to the political aspects of this, but again, we believe that the decision, the verdicts in Holy Land are just another shameful chapter in our history.
That's the voice of attorney Linda Moreno speaking to us from Tampa, Florida. And Linda, you represented Ghassan Elashi. Talk about his ordeal and what his family has gone through and his situation right now as he's being held in this communications management unit. Talk about what that looks like and what his day-to-day is like.
Well, I mean, it is, you know, I think that Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights described these CMUs as prisons for Muslims. And that's what they are. They are isolated, really concrete graves. I just can't be diplomatic about that. Ghassan Elashi is one of my very favorite clients I've had in 32 years of criminal defense practice. So he is a highly principled individual who, after receiving a sentence of 65 years for feeding Palestinian women and children, told the court boldly and bravely, I might add, that it was his honor to do so. That's who Ghassan Elashi was and is, and that's who the rest of the gentlemen in the Holy Land case were. On a day-to-day basis, it is the worst kind of confinement imaginable. It's solitary. The communications with the families are never contact visits. They're through glass and through the phone. Email contact and phone contact is severely restricted. There are no worse places for confinement than these CMUs, which now has the Holy Land individuals in it. So it is the most unjust ending for what was a brilliant philanthropic career for Ghassan Halashi.
And now, of course, we have to talk about the next steps and moving forward. The family and others have talked about now gathering steam to pressing for exoneration and release. Talk about the logistics involved in that and where the struggle is now.
Well, I mean, I think that I can't really speak to exoneration. Legally, with respect to the courts, I believe that we've exhausted the legal direction. I think there is a political direction. I have to leave it to others to really articulate that movement more aptly, because I've been so involved in the legal aspect of this case. Certainly, the Holy Land Foundation case is the case that needs to be discussed. Some of the lawyers on the team are going to be writing articles, not only legal articles, but op-eds and papers around the world. This was a case that was followed by international charities because of its precedent-setting decisions in it. So this was a case that not only affected the Holy Land Five and their families, but it affected the notion of charitable giving around the world. And it set a dangerous precedent that, if you're a Muslim, if you cannot practice your zakat, you cannot practice your religion. So that is one casualty of this case. But in the general sense of charitable giving and donations, what this case stands for is if you are a person who donates out of goodwill, and this government decides that where your money lands might have gone through channels that they believe were associated with terrorist organizations, this is highly problematic. So this decision has negative, pervasive, wide-ranging consequences, not only to Muslims and their charitable giving, but to donations around the world. The families have suffered terribly, terribly, not only materially, because the fathers are now all imprisoned, but emotionally and psychologically. But I will say that being close to the Halashi family and seeing other families who have been victims of this kind of devastating prosecutions, that I always marvel, I who am not a Muslim, I always marvel at what strength the faith gives these families.
Linda Moreno, thank you for all of your work and for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Thank you so much.
And for more on the story, including a transcribed interview about the Supreme Court's decision with Michael Ratner, civil rights attorney and president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights in New York City, visit electronicintifada.net. Jillian Kessler-Damour reported this week on the expanding attacks by Israeli settlers on Palestinian land and agriculture during the annual olive harvest. Along with Palestinians' increasing loss of access to their land due to Israeli army closures and the growing settlement blocks, the United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs stated that in just the month of October alone, Israeli settlers have vandalized or destroyed approximately 1,000 olive trees belonging to Palestinians. Kessler Damore added in her report that, quote, this destruction has had a negative impact on the economic viability of the olive oil industry, which supports approximately 80,000 Palestinian families and accounts for 14% of the income from Palestinian agriculture. That was from a report by Gillian Kessler Damore. For much more on this story, visit electronicintifada.net. This week, the Electronic Intifada premiered Not a Dreamland, a multimedia documentary project highlighting artists and alternative subcultures in Gaza. This multimedia feature combines videos, photographs, and sounds collected in February 2012 by Anne Pack of the Active Stills Photography Collective, exploring vibrant subcultures in the occupied and besieged Gaza Strip. This short, produced by Active Stills, features both established artists and performers, as well as lesser-known youth who experiment with parkour, beatbox, breakdancing, and roller skating. Interview extracts and striking images give context to the conditions under which these artists create, giving vivid insight into a vibrant side of Gaza that is rarely shown. Here's an excerpt of Not a Dreamland.
Ready?
Not too many people know beatbox in Gaza, and everyone say, what the hell are you doing? It's not a talent.
Okay, my name is Muhammad Abu Sal. I make painting, photography, installation now.
Okay, my name is Awad Fal Jadili. Now I'm a filmmaker.
My name is Samar Abu Al-Aw. I'm a photographer of Gaza.
Okay, I'm Khalil Mzayen. مخرج سينما
انا محمد ابو ناصر طبعا عرب معروف اكثر في غزه فنان تشكيله طبعا انهيت دراسه الفنون التشكيليه انا واخويا التوام طرزان
ماي نيم از ايمن مغامس ام بارت اوف باند كول بي اور ذا فلسطينيين رابرز
ماي نيم زراء عيسى اي ام ان ارتست بينتر Normal, the people don't think about art because we have many problems in Gaza.
Nobody care because the people care about how make a life.
اليوم فيش بنزين في غزة، فيش كهرباء في غزة. مين اللي بده يسيب كل هذه الإشكاليات وبدروح يقول فن والسينما ومش عارف إيش؟
We are from Gaza. We are playing breakdance and parkour and jump. We name the group is Freeline Gaza. Thank you.
You cannot just live in a hell and accept it. You have to struggle to survive. You have to fight in order to find your rights and look for a better future.
And that was an excerpt of Not a Dreamland, a short documentary highlighting artists and alternative subcultures in the Gaza Strip. To view the documentary, which is produced by Active Stills with support from the Electronic Intifada, go to electronicintifada.net. And now we go to news from the global boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement. The Electronic Intifada reported this week that activists in South Africa have welcomed a decision by the African National Congress's International Solidarity Conference to support the Palestinian-led campaign of boycott, divestment, and sanctions against Israel. In our Activism and BDS blog, the Electronic Intifada reported that, quote, the ANC, South Africa's ruling party, led the decades-long struggle against apartheid. The official declaration of the conference held in Pretoria, Shwane, last week, quote, reiterated its support for Palestinian aspirations for an independent state, including the full membership of the UN, and called on the UN Security Council to show leadership in halting the expansion of Israeli settlements and the harassment of Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails. It also stated that the conference, quote, supports the call of civil society's BDS campaign, end quote. Earlier in the week, more than 150 international anti-apartheid activists called on the ANC to boycott Israel in a statement that was read by the Electronic Intifada contributor, Adri Newhoff. The call had the support of signatories from more than 19 countries and more than 35 organizations. Activism group BDS South Africa said in a press release distributed via email, quote, there is widespread support from international delegates for the adoption and support of the Palestinian BDS call. However, there was one objection from a delegate from Germany who argued that Israel cannot be compared to apartheid South Africa, and thus an all-out boycott of Israel is, quote, ill-informed. The ANC chairperson, Baleka Mbete, strongly responded, saying that she has been to Palestine herself and that the Israeli regime is not only comparable, but, quote, far worse than apartheid South Africa. Ms. Mbete received a resounding round of applause from delegates for articulating this position, end quote. Mbete, the national chairperson of the ANC, was deputy president of the Republic of South Africa from 2008 to 2009 and is a former speaker of the National Assembly. Mohamed Desai of BDS South Africa, who heard Mbete make her statement, told the Electronic Intifada that the adoption of the BDS call was, quote, an absolutely beautiful moment. For more on this story and other important news from the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, go to electronicintifada.net and check out our activism and BDS blog. And that's it for our weekly Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features, and reviews, pointed opinion and analysis, and action alerts by our team of correspondents and bloggers, visit us online at electronicintifada.net. This week, be sure to check out our news features, including an op-ed by Professor Terry Ginsberg, who asks, why is a New York hospital being sacrificed for an Israel-backed science facility? Also, Badur Hassan writes an op-ed about a Druze youth from the Galilee who faces jail time for refusing to serve in Israel's army. Poet and activist Remy Kanazi debuts his new poem in a video, Normalize This, which exposes the injustices of normalization and much more. At electronicintifada.net, you can also post comments and sign up for our daily newsletter. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and a special thanks to Flashpoints and KPFA in Berkeley. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.